The American POTUS Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit show supported by listener patriots just like you. To help us keep the program going, please join others around the nation by considering a tax-deductible donation. You can make your contribution and see what exciting plans we have for new podcasts and other outreach programs at AmericanPOTUS.org. Thank you for your support, and we hope you enjoy this episode. On this episode of American POTUS, the 39th president, Jimmy Carter. His one term was full of challenges, foreign and domestic, including inflation, fuel shortages, and the Iran hostage crisis. Ultimately, those issues were too big to overcome, and he was shown the White House door a bit earlier than he would have liked. But his idea of retirement is different than most, working around the globe to ensure fair elections and building homes for those less fortunate. The peanut farmer from Plains, who changed the world during and after his presidency, Jimmy Carter, next on American POTUS. I'm Scott Brun with the National Museum of American Presidents. With the help of presidential scholar Alan Lowe, we're opening the book on the men who have held our nation's highest office. In each episode, we'll tap into our nationwide cabinet of historians, authors, experts, and others to reveal the most compelling moments from these extraordinary patriots. Our guest for this episode on our 39th POTUS is Jonathan Alter. He's interviewed seven different presidents over his career, written three New York Times bestsellers, and he won an Emmy for Best Historical Documentary in 2020. From time to time, you'll see him on NBC News and MSNBC as a political correspondent and political analyst. Jonathan, thanks for joining us to talk about James Earl Carter Jr., better known as simply Jimmy.
My pleasure. It's good to be here.
Jonathan, I so enjoyed your biography of Jimmy Carter. Really so well done. You know, I've had the pleasure of meeting him a couple times through the years. I at one point served as the director of the George W. Bush Library down in Dallas, and the president, Mrs. Carter, showed all the library directors through the wonderfully redone exhibit down in Atlanta at the Carter Library and Museum. It was really just an amazing day with them. And I always remember at the end of that day, we went into a meeting room with them, and he asked all of us directors what questions we had. And never have I seen my fellow directors so tongue-tied. We stared at him. I don't know. There was a nervousness. And finally, I asked him about his work in Africa, and he talked about that probably for 20 or 30 minutes thereafter. But it was amazing to me that someone who is known kind of as a quiet personality kind of belies the fact that he has a large amount of charisma and presence when you're around him.
Yeah, that's a story that's very reflective of Jimmy Carter. He's somebody who, when he was campaigning for president, was seen as a absolute master of the small room, mm-hmm. you know, of that kind of retail politics, especially not so much the glad handing, although he could do that when he needed to, although he didn't like it, but mm-hmm. a small session with voters or experts in your case, or any group of people where he could answer their questions, because mm-hmm. his answers, and you can see this from his presidential press conferences to him on the campaign trail, his answers are always very substantive and very to the point. And when he doesn't know the answer, he says it, which is very refreshing
yes.
for audiences. So when he went from 0% in the polls to being the Democratic nominee for president in 1976 and then the president, it was at least in part because he left small groups impressed, no matter who they were. Bigger audiences, TV, different situation. You know, and in those cases, he was generally outperformed, say, by Ronald Reagan, who was mm-hmm. called the great communicator. And, you know, Carter on TV, his eyes would bug out sometimes. Or he would not emphasize the right words in a prepared speech, which he didn't often deliver very well. And he had some problems, that part of the job. And he knew, actually, I uncovered a memo that he wrote early in the 76 campaign saying that he knew he wasn't good on TV and had to get better at it.
Well, let's step back in this wonderful biography again to the beginning. I was really fascinated with your picture of him as a kid and the influence that his parents, Earl and Lillian, had on him in shaping his personality. Could you tell us a bit about that?
His father, Earl, was a strict disciplinarian, extremely hard worker, which he gave to his son, and not incidentally a white supremacist. And so like every other white man in that area, practically. And his mother was the eccentric maverick in the family, Lillian Carter, who when Jimmy was president, she was one of Johnny Carson's favorite guests because she was a real character. But when he was growing up, she was a nurse, and she later went into the Peace Corps at age 68. And she took care of black patients in their tiny community and would take Jimmy to black churches sometimes, and was the only person in Sumter County who ever had anything nice to say about Abraham Lincoln. And I think, you know, his interest in global health definitely came from his mother and his interest in the wider world. She was a real reader, and he became a reader, and they had this kind of strange habit of reading at the dinner table. Everybody would be reading his or her own book. You know, when people married into the family later on, I thought that was very strange, although Rosalind and Jimmy did that with their kids too, a fair amount of the time. But there really was a third parent, I learned, and that is a woman named Rachel Clark, who was a black farmhand, wife of the foreman, black foreman on the Carter property. And she signed her name with an X, illiterate, but Jimmy thought of her as an African queen, he called her, when he was a boy. And she taught him about nature and spiritual things. And after Jimmy's mother died, he was seen weeping at Rachel Clark's grave. He loved his mother and he wept at her grave too, but he admitted after his mother died that Rachel had actually been more of a mother to him than Lillian, who was gone during her nursing a lot of the time. And so he really, in many ways, had three parents. His relationship with his father was difficult, and they fell out toward the end of Earl Carter's life over race. Jimmy was in the Navy and believed in integration, and that made Earl very unhappy, and they were estranged. But then when Earl got cancer in 1953, and Jimmy went home and talked to him on his deathbed and saw that there were black people from their community who were very shaken up and recounting nice things that Earl had done for them, he realized that, you know, it was more complicated. And then he left the Navy, came home, and assumed many of his father's civic responsibilities and took over his father's business in the early 1950s. But then kind of ducked the civil rights movement, which is probably the least flattering part of the Carter epic story, and of course made up for it in the second half of his life.
Now, you mentioned the Navy, and that's where another big personality is in his life, and that's Admiral Rickover. He worked on a nuclear sub and rose pretty quickly in the Navy, but Rickover was harsh, brilliant, demanding. What was that relationship like, and did it have any long-lasting impact on Carter and his personality?
I think it did, and, you know, Carter revered Admiral Rickover. Important to understand that nuclear submarines were the most exciting and most important technological innovation of the middle part of the 20th century. And Colin Powell later said that Admiral Rickover's nuclear submarines and later nuclear-powered aircraft carriers won the Cold War because these submarines could stay underwater for much, much longer than the Russian subs, and it changed the strategic balance, especially when we had, you know, missiles on those submarines. So the achievement that he was responsible for was something that Jimmy Carter shared in, because he worked on the second prototype for a nuclear submarine. Remember, at this time in the early 1950s, there were not nuclear power plants on land yet. And we were at the dawn of the peaceful use of nuclear energy. It was only a few years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it was actually an experimental reactor that melted down, and Rickover sent Carter, and he had to run through the reactor to try to save it, and he was only allowed to be in there for 90 seconds. But it was really very much like being in war. Again, something that almost nobody has ever written anything about, and I dug up all sorts of papers. But Rickover was a real son of a bitch, and by all accounts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his interviews were infamous. You know, he would tell you to go over and open the window and it would be nailed shut. He wanted to see how you would react. Or he would say, do something to piss me off. And so one guy got in by just sweeping everything off of Rickover's desk. And he said to another one, you got a girlfriend, call her and break it off. You can't be in my program if you don't do that. And when the guy picked up the phone to call his girlfriend, he threw him out of his office because he was too easy to push around. So Carter's interview wasn't that bad, but Rickover asked him after quizzing him on obscure classical music and really, really hard questions. He says, where did you stand in your class at the Naval Academy? He said, 59th. And he said, did you do your best? And Carter answered honestly, which turned out to be the right move. He said, well, no, I didn't always do my best. He said, why not? And he swiveled around his chair. The interview was over. And Carter thought he hadn't gotten in. But the rest of his life, and one of the reasons why I called the book His Very Best, is that Carter never phoned it in. He never went on Miller time, really, from that day in 1952. Even when he's exercising, he's all in, you know. Right. He's trying to be the best possible fly fisherman he can possibly be. And this, you know, some of this came from his father, but a lot of it came from Admiral Rickover. And even though he wasn't as cold as Rickover, he wasn't as harsh as Rickover, he did inherit some of that, and his staff and his family, you know, felt like he took a little bit too much from Rickover's personality later in his life. And you know, he could be very difficult. Some of his successors in office, like Bill Clinton and George Bush and even Barack Obama, you know, they experienced how difficult he could be. So, you know, part of his complexity is sometimes he's the, you know, the guy in the Mr. Rogers sweater with the, you know, with the Zen countenance. And that's part of Jimmy Carter, but also the steely-eyed, sometimes really chilly guy and highly demanding is another part of him. And that part comes from Admiral Rickover.
Yeah. Well, Rickover has given me inspiration on how I will interview employees from now on. I will say that. And also, I'm very curious, not to get completely diverted on this, what is the right answer on the nailed down window question? I'm very curious what he would expect you to do in that instance. I guess I'd have to break the window. Maybe that's what he wants. I'm not sure.
That's a really good question. I'm not sure there was a right answer, but I think it would be something along the lines of, you know, he wanted you to look at it like an engineer. I mean, Carter thought Rickover was the greatest engineer in human history because the pyramids were like a joint project, but the nuclear Navy, even though there were thousands of people, you know, working on these projects, Rickover was truly the father of the nuclear Navy. Yeah. And so I think that he wanted to see whether people could approach it from a problem-solving engineering perspective. So, you know, determine that it's nailed shut, and then ask Rickover, you know, can I get a tool here to get the nails out of this window? And, you know, try to figure it out the way you would have to if something went wrong on a nuclear submarine.
So I would have failed when I took the stapler and threw it through the window, but that's okay. It's okay. I really don't belong on a nuclear sub anyway. So you mentioned earlier, Jimmy made the big decision at a certain point after his father's death to quit the Navy and to go back to Plains and run the family business. And when he got there, he showed this political ambition. And with that political ambition, then he had to take on some pretty controversial issues sometimes, including that race issue, which was kept swirling around him. Why did he get into politics when it could have adversely affected his business?
Well, because he was public-spirited. You know, he was only in politics for 12 years. He's 96 now, and only 12 years in public office, four as a state senator, four as governor, and four as president. But he has been a civic leader since he came back from the Navy in 1953. And so he assumed his father's many civic responsibilities and then joined a bunch of others. I mean, I could reel off all of the, you know, all of the clubs he was in. And you know, he was one of them was he was on the Sumter County School Board, and he eventually became the chair of the Sumter County School Board. And he wanted to improve education. And he figured that the only way he could really do that, you know, was to go into politics. But he couldn't go into politics before they changed the courthouse boss system that was in existence in Georgia at that time. And when they did, after the one man, one vote Supreme Court decision, made it possible for reformers like him to go into politics. But in his first race, they tried to steal it from him, and this county boss literally, not figuratively, he literally stuffed the ballot boxes, and Carter had to go to court. But unlike Donald Trump, he actually presented evidence in court, solid evidence, irrefutable evidence that the election had been stolen from him, and they eventually had another vote, and he won. In that race, race was not an issue because it was in 1962, and almost no blacks could vote in Georgia. It was before the Voting Rights Act. But in 1963 and in 1965, Sumter County, the county seat is a town of 9,000 called Americus, Plains, Georgia, where Carter is from, and Rosalynn is 650 people. That's how small it is.
Wow.
But in Americus, it was the site of a lot of racial strife and what you could only be described as white terrorism, where, you know, not just Klan marches, but the local sheriff who made Bull Connor look like a nice guy, you know, using cattle prods on 14-year-old black girls. And Tom Brokaw, who was a reporter for the Atlanta station at that time, his first time on network news was covering what was going on in Americus. And Carter was the state senator, and people knew that he was liberal for that area, you know, but he felt like he couldn't step out or he would end his political career and his business would be threatened. So a few years earlier, for instance, there was a boycott of an interracial farm very close to Plains, where the guy who ran it, the white Christian leader of the interracial farm, Clarence Jordan, who was Hamilton Jordan's uncle, Hamilton Jordan was later Carter's top aide. He was one of Martin Luther King's mentors, and King was afraid to go there because he thought that it was such a target for white terrorism. And Carter actually joined the boycott of that farm, wouldn't sell them farm products and from Carter's warehouse, his business. And when I first saw that, I go, wow, why wouldn't he do that? And then I found out that one of his competitors broke the boycott, sold that farm supplies, and his business was dynamited. So this was, it was very rough there. And by the way, that farm later, the housing ministry that was part of that interracial farm, which was called Koinonia, it later turned into an organization called Habitat for Humanity. And so needless to say, Jimmy Carter, became very close to the people who founded and ran that farm. But that's just part of this epic story. And it's not really so much one of his changing his views on race, because from childhood, he had, he took after his mother and he had an enlightened view on race, but he couldn't come out of the closet on it and ducked the civil rights movement. Didn't even meet Martin Luther King, you know, when he was in the state Senate, and later became very friendly with Daddy King, but, and the rest of the King family. When he was governor, he became a very liberal governor who integrated Georgia government and put up Dr. King's portrait in the state capitol. But it was after a campaign in 1970 where he used dog whistles and code words to appeal to the segregationists that he thought he needed to put him in office. And when I questioned him about it, and at one point he said, "Are we done talking about this?"
Yes,
very softly. And yeah. I said, "President Carter, I have a few more questions on this," because it was an uncomfortable subject for him.
Sure.
He finally said, "Look, I could either denounce, if I had to do it over again, would I have denounced the segregationists? Yes, but then I wouldn't have been governor of Georgia." You know, so he made a politically expedient issue that if he could get in office, he would do the right thing. And he did.
He did.
So, this is part of the complexity of politics, that, you know, you can't expect purity from your politicians or they can't win, but you need them to stand up and do the right thing when it's important. And he never himself engaged in any racist rhetoric or anything like that, but he did let the impression be conveyed that he welcomed the support of the bad guys.
Yeah. So after that time in the state Senate and 4 years as governor, this relative unknown becomes president. How in the world, you know, the whole Jimmy Who, how did he manage to accomplish going from that zero rating to a victory in 1976?
Well, he would not have been president if it wasn't for Watergate and the lies of the Vietnam era just before Watergate. And so his campaign theme of healing and accountability, and similar in some ways to Joe Biden's campaign, who, by the way, was his first supporter in the U.S. Senate, it was perfectly timed for the mood of the country in 1975 and 76. But he also had a quite brilliant campaign strategy, and the Iowa caucuses had really just started 4 years earlier and hadn't been important. And he and his people recognized that they could use them as a launching pad. And they did. And they did a lot of retail politics there. He was out of office. He wasn't by law allowed to run again for re-election as governor of Georgia in 1974. And as he told me, he probably would have lost if he had been able to run again, because he had so alienated the very conservative rural counties that had put him in office in the first place. But he understood the map better than his competitors, who were well-known senators, and he understood the themes that he needed to strike. And then where he really won it was by beating George Wallace in the Florida primary in 1976. And Wallace had been confined to a wheelchair after having been shot in 1972. But, you know, he was a really formidable figure, saying a lot of the same kinds of things, although actually not as inflammatory as Donald Trump. If you can believe it, Trump was sort of Wallace squared in the kinds of things that he would say. But by beating Wallace, he not only really set himself on course to the nomination, but he basically eliminated the racist wing of the Democratic Party, which went back to the founding of the Democratic Party in the 1790s, because the Democratic Party is the oldest party in America. And, you know, it had been the party of the segregationists, and Republicans were the party of Lincoln, right? So the Democratic Party had a racist wing for its entire existence until Carter beat Wallace in Florida. And then you could not be an avowed racist and a Democrat. It was no longer possible. If you wanted to engage in that kind of bigotry, you had to go into the other major political party, as millions of people did. So that the South moved from solidly Democratic to solidly Republican. And that was happening. So Carter won the South in 76 because they were so proud. There hadn't been a Southerner elected since Zachary Taylor in 1848. And so it was a big regional pride thing for the South. But then Reagan carried the South, and every Republican has, since. I mean, Bill Clinton got a couple border states and Georgia. You know, Carter carried Georgia twice, and we know what happened in Georgia this year. But, you know, generally the Deep South has been Republican.
If you want to know more about our guest expert, Jonathan Alter, or check out some of his terrific books, simply visit AmericanPOTUS.com. We have a resource section there with links to all of the best-selling books he's written on the presidency. And while you're there, send us a note and let us know what you think of this or any other episode.
Now, let's turn for just a moment to Jimmy and Rosalynn. You paint a picture of that relationship, a real love affair, but also an amazing business and political partnership. Can you tell us a bit about how they met and how she approached politics and her activities as First Lady?
So they actually met, and this just blew me away when I learned about this. They met when Rosalynn was only a few days old in 1927. And so think about how long ago that is. That's 93 years ago. And Ms. Lillian, Jimmy's mother, delivered Rosalynn Smith, and they lived in the neighborhood at that time. It was before the Carters moved to a farm in Archery outside of Plains. And so the nurse brought her nearly three-year-old son over to see the new baby. And then they didn't really know each other for a number of years, except that Rosalynn was Ruth Carter's friend, Jimmy's sister, younger sister. And when Jimmy was in the Navy, Rosalynn kind of fell in love with his picture and his uniform. And when he was home on leave from the Naval Academy, they fell in love. And then they got married in 1946, shortly after his graduation from Annapolis. And Rosalynn gave me the really, I think there's no other word than steamy, love letters that Jimmy wrote her from sea when he was on board a ship. And they testified, and they are the most explicit love letters ever between a future president and future first lady. And they had never even been seen, much less published before by a historian. And the intensity of their love is clear from that early point. And they had an extraordinary, and continue to have an extraordinary partnership. And she became, I think it's fair to say, on policy, in terms of being a close advisor to her husband, the most influential first lady ever. And so the Time magazine at one point did a story about, you know, who the president would summon when there was a crisis. And it said, Rosalynn is Big, that's his national security advisor. Cy is Cyrus Vance's secretary of state. Ham, that's Hamilton Jordan, who later became his chief of staff. And then Hugh Seide, the Time magazine columnist, said, note the order. Rosalynn first. And it got a lot of publicity that she sat in on cabinet meetings, but that really wasn't the half of it. She worked as a diplomat for him, you know, traveling to South America. She was responsible for the first major mental health legislation that was all her baby. She was among the first people to raise age discrimination as an issue. She and the wife of the senator, Betty Bumpers, they went around to the states and convinced most of them to pass laws requiring inoculations before children could go to school. Before that, there was no such requirement. And the list goes on. So these are really substantive contributions that she made. And of course, it continued after he left office, and she traveled all over the world with him on peacekeeping missions and monitoring elections. And that was really a partnership in the running of the Carter Center. And she has her own initiatives there, the Rosalynn Carter Center on caregiving. But one of the things I found that, you know, I really enjoyed my conversations with her. And she was the political brains in the family. And she was always telling her husband, you know, to think more about the politics or he wouldn't get reelected. And she was right. And she had better political instincts, as he admits, than he did. But what I found that was especially interesting was that, unlike a number of other first ladies, the staff really liked her too. So they would sometimes go to her if they wanted to get a message to her husband. Usually the spouse of the politician, the staff is very wary of, and it's not common that everybody likes the first lady. And I have yet to find anybody who had a critical word to say about her, and the same can not be said by any stretch of the imagination about her husband, who had many enemies.
Well, really an amazing woman, amazing first lady, and an amazing partnership. So let's dig in real quick on a couple of the issues he had to deal with as president. And one of those was the energy crisis. And you do a really great job of detailing what he did to confront that crisis. You say it was terribly underappreciated then and now. Can you tell us why you view it that way and what the long-term consequences were of his actions?
Well, I think everybody knows, or a lot of people know, that he put solar panels on the roof of the White House, and then Ronald Reagan had them taken down. And that was, you know, symbolic. But there were actually 14 major pieces of energy and environmental legislation. And he understood from the start that we had to decrease our reliance on foreign oil. And, you know, we had to achieve some kind of energy independence. And so some of the things he did would be seen as conservative, like he deregulated natural gas, which liberals got very upset about. But that kicked off an enormous natural gas boom that we are benefiting from to this day. And, you know, we found all kinds of natural gas. Some of the ideas, like Synthetic Fuels Corporation, for instance, didn't work very well. Other ideas were, you know, you would call liberal, like the first president to fund clean energy, first president to impose fuel economy standards, and the first toxic waste cleanup. On the conservation end, he was the greatest conservationist president since Theodore Roosevelt, by adding and protecting 105 million acres in Alaska and a bunch of other national parks too, which doubled the size of the national park system. And, you know, but it was rough going because energy is not a sexy issue. It was hard to get the country behind him on it when there were long gas lines in the summer of 1979, even though it wasn't his fault. You know, Americans were understandably really ticked off about it, and his popularity plummeted. And then he made some mistakes in trying to right the ship. But at the end of the day, he did get, in pieces, the first genuine energy policy this country had ever had, as well as establishing the Department of Energy to consolidate various energy efforts in different parts of the government. I found in his files that as early as 1971, he was underlining articles in the journal Nature about what was then called carbon pollution, and we now know as global warming or climate change. And, you know, other presidents would be off playing golf and Carter play tennis, but he, you know, he liked to read scientific journals. That's how he got his, you know. And so he was aware that in a scientific community, there was this concern. And actually, the Council on Environmental Quality issued a report that recommended, which he adopted, that recommended that the U.S. move toward the same climate change goals as were adopted in 2015 in the Paris Agreement. This is in 1980. And Carter agreed, and we were going to start recognizing, we wouldn't have, you know, gotten off fossil fuel immediately, but he would have accelerated efforts to move away from fossil fuel had he been reelected. And it adds a little bit of a, you know, tragic dimension to that 1980 election, that, you know, we would have been beginning to address this problem in the early 1980s had Jimmy Carter been reelected.
You know, I think even many of those Americans who were upset with long gas lines in 79, many of his detractors still would say he accomplished a lot in the Middle East, particularly with the Camp David Accords between Israel and Egypt. Where did that passion of his come from for seeking that peace in the Middle East that seemed like a no-win situation, particularly when he was dealing with big personalities like Sadat and Begin?
It's a great question. You know, it comes from his religious conviction and his, he always calls that part of the world the Holy Land. Mm-hmm. And, you know, was our most devout president, I think, by most historians' account. And so when he visited the Middle East for the first time when he was governor in 1973, and Golda Meir gave him a car to drive around, and, you know, he started, I think, what became a passion, almost an obsession, began pretty early. And then when he met Anwar Sadat, he developed a very close relationship with him. The same could not be said of his relationship with Menachem Begin, the prime minister of Israel. But when Sadat went to Jerusalem, Carter thought that there was a chance for peace. And remember, Israel and Egypt had fought four wars in the previous 25 years. And Carter brings them together at Camp David, and he realizes very early in the 13-day conference. I thought they were going to be there for 3 days. But he realized very early that the two men could not be in the same room at the same time. They were just yelling at each other. And so he engaged in unprecedented presidential diplomacy. Usually presidents have their secretaries of state or somebody else do the actual negotiating, because if it doesn't go well, it's on them, and it's a huge political risk. Carter did it by himself. It was a virtuoso performance. It led to the most enduring peace treaties since World War II. There hasn't been a shot fired in anger between those two countries in 47 years. And yet they could not get the peace between Egypt and Israel was only part of what they were after. They were also trying to get to full autonomy for the Palestinians and eventually a Palestinian state. And obviously that part of Camp David has gone less well. But what amazed me was that the whole thing fell apart after they came back from Camp David. Mm-hmm. And Carter had to go 6 months later to the Middle East and put the whole thing back together again with, you know, chewing gum and baling wire and duct tape, right? And at huge, huge political risk. And all of his advisors saying, don't do this. This thing is dead. It didn't work. Nice try. Don't do this. But his obsession led him to do it. And then he's tried a lot and gotten a lot of criticism because arguably he's tilted too much toward the Arabs in the years since, and hasn't been hugely effective in his post-presidency. But I think what, you know, I try to say to my fellow Jews about this is that, you know, who are many of them whom are uncomfortable with Jimmy Carter, and he was the only Democratic nominee who got less than a majority of the Jewish vote, and that was in 1980, that you should judge people by their deeds more than their words. So if you want to look at words, yeah, he's more pro-Palestinian. But if you look at deeds, Camp David, it made him the greatest security president for the state of Israel since Harry Truman, who had the founding, because the Egyptian army was the only, you know, before the Iranian threat, the Egyptian army was the only existential threat to Israel. And he took it off the table, which is a huge, huge achievement, and only one of his foreign policy achievements. There are a few others. And I want to be careful, just want to interject here that, you know, he made a lot of mistakes, and I don't sugarcoat where he went wrong. But I think this sort of easy shorthand, you know, failed president, great former president, it just doesn't bear scrutiny when you look at it more closely.
Yeah, I think you give a very good balanced view, and you certainly do talk about the victories and the defeats and the mistakes and the successes. Certainly Camp David Accords, certainly the Panama Canal treaties were something he wanted and he got, and another success from his viewpoint. But when you get to Iran, that's where things really go bad, with the Iranian revolution that changed everything then and now. And you note that really the Iranian crisis kind of was able to sneak up on the Carter administration. Why was that the case? Why did they not realize more what was happening there?
So there's no easy answer to that question. Before I get to that, I just want to briefly mention that, you know, the Panama Canal treaties, when I first heard about them, I said, well, that's not hugely interesting. Turns out there's this fascinating story, and that if he hadn't won approval, which required two-thirds, we would have had an open-ended guerrilla war in Panama. We'd probably still be dealing with it. The Joint Chiefs said it would require a minimum of 100,000 troops if the canal zone became a war zone, which would have happened. Remember, the canal is vital to, you know, global commerce. It would have happened if Carter hadn't gotten these treaties through the Senate. And then he established diplomatic relations, full diplomatic relations with China. And Deng Xiaoping's visit was, he thinks that will be the most historic thing that he does, because that bilateral relationship is the basis of today's global economy, for better or for worse.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and at the time, China had the GDP of a sub-Saharan African country. So this was a hugely significant thing with China, and by no means inevitable. And then the human rights policy, first time a global standard for how governments treat their own people, was made part of the policy of the United States. And, you know, there was a great Harvard professor of international relations who saw Carter, who was a little depressed after his defeat, saw him at Emory University. And he said, you know, President Carter, you'll be remembered 1,000 years from now for your human rights policy. It was a hypocritical policy in many ways. They supported the Shah of Iran and Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines and so forth. But it did help end the Cold War, as a lot of conservatives later acknowledged. And it set this standard that is so in tune with American values. But Iran was pretty much of a fiasco. And the revolution in early 1979, the Shah of Iran fled. It's equaled only by the Russian Revolution and the Chinese Revolution and its importance in the 20th century. And so much flowed from that Iranian Revolution. I don't think at the end of the day that there was anything that the United States ultimately could have done about it. The Shah of Iran's unwillingness to continue to shoot his own people was really what eventually, you know, led to the victory of the forces of the revolution. So he said, you know, a despot shoots its own people, a monarch does not. I'm a monarch. So even though he had this terrible secret police and many abuses, he would not just kind of, he said, if I mow down the revolutionaries on one street, then they'll just go to the next street. And he grew dejected and left. But Carter, whose attention to detail was so important at Camp David, in normalization with China, Alaska lands, you know, all of his big achievements, this attention to detail, which was often ridiculed at the time, was hugely important. And he was so busy with the aftermath of Camp David and other things and the upcoming visit of Deng Xiaoping, he kind of took his eye off the ball a little bit when Iran was breaking up, and he thought that we would be able to have relations with the new regime, that he didn't do enough to bolster the interim leader, who was, you know, pretty good, a guy everybody has forgotten about named Bakhtiar. He might have, in retrospect, been able to bolster him a little more. And then he, after initially resisting the urging of people like Henry Kissinger and John McCloy, a dean of the American establishment, and even Brzezinski to let the Shah come to the United States. And initially, Carter didn't want to do that because he thought it could be dangerous for our people in Iran. And at one point, he even said, F the Shah, except he didn't say F. You wouldn't think that would come out of Jimmy Carter's mouth. And I remember talking to Harold Brown, and he said, yeah, he was kind of surprised when he said that. I talked to Carter about it as well, but he didn't want to do it. And then what happened is that the Rockefellers, who were very tight with the Shah, they pulled the wool over the eyes of the State Department and eventually Carter, and they made it seem as if the Shah of Iran could not be treated for his cancer in Mexico, which is where he was at the time. He went to several different countries in the last 18 months of his life. And so Carter, on a humanitarian basis, let him in to a hospital in New York for treatment. And just days later, the militants seized the hostages in Tehran. So that was a bad decision on his part.
We'll get into the Iran hostage crisis in just a moment, but first a quick reminder to send us a note and let us know what you think of this or any other episode. You can reach us at AmericanPOTUS.com, Facebook, or Twitter. And while you're there, be sure to like or follow our page for upcoming features and announcements.
So in 1980, when he gets defeated by Ronald Reagan in the race for the presidency, could he have won? Was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the hostage crisis, was all that too much to overcome? The Kennedy challenge in the primaries, all that. Was there a path to victory for him in 1980?
There was. The election was actually quite close until the last 10 days. And there were, you know, polls that showed Carter in the lead, and people respected Carter and his character, and they were a little worried that Reagan was a unsteady cowboy. But Reagan calmed a lot of those concerns in their only debate shortly before the election. And I concluded that Carter's own analysis, that if he had one more helicopter when they had the hostage rescue mission in April of 1980, and the helicopters crashed in the desert, that if they had had one more helicopter, he would have been reelected. I don't even think Carter believed that, because I interviewed Paul Volcker, the late Paul Volcker, who Carter had appointed to be chairman of the Fed, and Volcker ended inflation. You know, Paul Volcker was a great man and a historic leader. But in order to end inflation, which was ravaging the American economy, he had to jack up interest rates. And he told Carter, "I'm going to be independent." And Carter appointed him anyway. And then, you know, he jacks up interest rates as high as 19%. They were 15% just a couple of months before the election. Right. And that is a gale force wind that you're riding into. And so, you know, arguably Volcker elected Reagan in 1980. And then because his harsh medicine worked, we had strong growth with no inflation, little inflation at the time of the 1984 election. And so he reelected Reagan, too. So I was talking to Volcker about this, and he said, "Well, you know, I was at a fishing lodge, and Carter was there one time in the 80s. And I said, and Volcker was a big admirer of Jimmy Carter. And he said, "You know, Mr. President, I'm sorry if I cost you the election." And Carter replied, "There were many factors," with a smile. And he was right. The Ted Kennedy challenge was very damaging. It really hurts an incumbent not to have a united party behind him. It didn't doom Donald Trump, but, you know, it's very, very harmful. And so that really hurt Carter. The economy, the hostages, a number of other things. There was, Cuban refugees at Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, rioted. And that doomed Bill Clinton, who was running for reelection as governor that year. And it hurt Carter, too. It just seemed like things were coming apart in 1980, and the job seemed too big for Carter, and he seemed like he had been swamped by events. And, you know, at first, after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan at the beginning of the year, Carter's popularity was up in the same way it had been right after the hostages were seized, which was exactly 1 year before Election Day. And he was beating Kennedy in the primaries. But then when it dragged on and on, the hostages aren't home, and the boycott of the Olympics and the grain embargo, which at first everybody rallied around the flag, supported it. But, you know, by spring, it was like, do we really have to not have Olympics? You know, Americans started to really question Carter's decisions, and all of these factors combined to basically swamp him. And so I concluded that he was a political failure, but a substantive and often far-sighted success, and that You know, as a journalist, we tend to judge people by how they're doing politically. Mm-hmm. But as a historian, you need to, I should say, as an historian, or some difference of opinion as to whether it's a or an,
right.
you know, we need to look at whether what they do and the decisions that they make improve America in the long term. And on that score, I think Jimmy Carter's presidency holds up well. He's not going to be on Mount Rushmore, but he did try to look over the horizon. And there are many things that we take for granted that were enacted when Jimmy Carter was president and signing an awful lot of legislation.
So with that perspective of time and the access now to the archives, and we know he's the model of an ex-president out in the country and the world doing good things, what would you say is his most important legacy?
Well, you know, when he left office, Walter Mondale, his vice president, and he had revolutionized the office of vice president. It had been a useless position before Mondale and has been a significant one since Mondale. He offered a toast, and he said, you know, we kept the peace, we obeyed the law, we told the truth. And so just in terms of character and decency, I think there's an important legacy. But on the substantive side, I think it's the idea of using government to solve problems. He's an engineer and a problem solver, and that we can, without having an overweening government, and Carter cut bureaucracy, deregulated where he thought that would help in the airline and trucking industry, which established the conditions for just-in-time delivery that now undergirds the American economy, and moved toward a balanced budget. He was a fiscal conservative in many ways, but he understood that presidents are put there to address the problems of the American people, not just the problems that year, but the longer term problems. And he was very, you know, he didn't just reform the civil service. He got through, for instance, Donald Trump would not have been impeached the first time if it wasn't for Jimmy Carter, because Carter introduced and signed the Ethics in Government Act that first protected whistleblowers. You can't understand what's going on in your government if you don't protect whistleblowers. First established inspectors general, first FISA courts. These are institutional things that are rarely associated with Jimmy Carter, but are part of this larger legacy of pragmatic problem solving in the presidency. So I think where human rights, Camp David, and China are his great legacies overseas, and the fact that there wasn't a shot fired in anger by any American military the first time since Thomas Jefferson was president. At home, problem solving is a big legacy, but the larger and most relevant legacy right now is one of values and decency and integrity. And if we don't have that in high office, we have nothing.
So again, I want to say how much I enjoyed this book. What is next for you, Jonathan, and where can people go to learn more about all of your work?
They can go to jonathanalter.com, and I have a lot of my old articles posted there, as well as my other books on Franklin Roosevelt and two books on Barack Obama. At jonathanalter.com is probably the best place. But I think in addition to his very best, my other books, they testify to my interest in the American presidency and in what presidents do to promote democracy. And that's very relevant right now, but was also hugely important in the story of, say, Franklin Roosevelt's debut in the presidency.
Well, Jonathan, we'd like to give our listeners a bit of a glimpse into the personal side of Jimmy Carter with a few short but insightful questions. Can you help us out with this?
Absolutely.
What would you say would be the biggest do-over of his presidency?
I think it would be the two things I mentioned. One would be not letting the Shah of Iran into the United States, because then he would not have had the hostage crisis. Yeah. And the other would be to send, you know, he already ordered one additional helicopter, actually two. He ordered two more helicopters, and that wasn't enough. So if he'd had a third helicopter, I think he would say, if he'd done that, that maybe that very dramatic rescue mission would have been successful. I'm not sure it would have been. I think that when the commandos got to Tehran, that it would have been harder than they thought to free the hostages. But that's what Carter would say, is that he wished he had more helicopters.
And on the opposite side of that, what would you say was his luckiest moment?
In general, I think he was a very lucky candidate and a very unlucky president. So
interesting.
I would say that his luckiest moment as a candidate was that Morris Udall, who was a very appealing rival for the nomination in 1976, that he kept falling just short, and he finished second in several primaries. And if Udall, who was more popular inside the Democratic Party, had managed to, say, win the Wisconsin primary, he could have ended up as the nominee. And Carter just kept lucking out, winning by just, you know, a few thousand votes in primary after primary.
Who do you think his favorite president would be, past or present?
His favorite president is Harry Truman. And he put Truman's sign, "The Buck Stops Here," on his desk in the Oval Office. And he was in the Navy in 1948 when Truman desegregated the armed forces, which he considered to be a very important thing to happen. And he admired Truman's approach to governing. He actually wasn't that much of a New Deal liberal. And even though he kicked off his campaign at Warm Springs, Georgia, where Roosevelt went, his father was a big opponent of the New Deal and didn't really have the New Deal in his bones. He was more of a Truman man.
Now, you obviously know a thing or two about the presidents and the presidencies. Is there a president who's done more with his post-presidential private life than Jimmy Carter?
Not with his post-presidential private life. Yeah. So John Quincy Adams went to Congress after he was president. And if anybody's seen the movie Amistad, they know that he did important work on fighting the slave trade in Congress. And William Howard Taft was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court after he was president. But with the exception of those two, and certainly in terms of his private life, Carter has revolutionized the post-presidency. Yeah. And every one of his successors, even though he sometimes didn't get along with them all that well, has been measured by what Carter has done. And the Carter Center is a terrific institution. I mean, I think that, again, to go back to this sort of easy shorthand, you know, failed president, great former president. The problem with being a former president, as Donald Trump is going to learn, is you don't have any power anymore.
Yeah.
So Carter, you don't have any levers of power to use. So Carter got a lot more done as president than as a former president, but his unceasing commitment to bettering the world has made him a global icon, and for good reason. When you look at many of the things that he's done, particularly in the area of global health as a former president.
So let's get a little more personal. Does he have a favorite snack food? Surely it isn't peanuts, right?
Well, you know, at one point when I was in Plains and we were going to have dinner with him later that evening, in the afternoon, as he was showing me around his boyhood home, he gave me and my wife a bag of boiled peanuts. But generally, I think that he's so disciplined. He is especially for somebody like me who is not hugely disciplined. He's so disciplined. He weighs the same as he did when he was a young man. And I think the honest answer, this is a guess, is that he doesn't really snack, because snacking is kind of undisciplined.
Yeah, so, right. Is that his secret? I mean, he's 96 now. Is that his secret to staying healthy and active?
Well, he has, you know, always gotten a lot of exercise. And he would say his secret to being alive is that he never smoked. And his father and all of his siblings died of pancreatic cancer. And he, you know, when he got cancer, it was not pancreatic. And he did the research and said, attributed that at least in part to his not smoking. But he and Rosalind eat really well. And they wrote a book called Everything to Gain. They wrote it together. It was a terrible experience for them. It was one of the low points in their marriage, because they quarreled throughout the writing of that book and never wrote another book again together. But Everything to Gain, Making the Most of the Rest of Your Life, has some good tips on growing old healthy. It's one of, it's an interesting book. And of course, writing books, whether it be books of poetry, collections of his paintings, book about fishing. He's a master carpenter. He has wonderful coffee table book on carpentry. You know, these give you some idea that When I and others have discussed it with him, he says that staying active is the most important thing after diet and exercise to longevity.
And I will say, Jonathan, I meant to mention this earlier, in the many books he's produced since the presidency, the one about his run for the state senate, I can't recall the title, is really wonderful. It really shows you that side of Carter, that real deep integrity and determination to overcome those obstacles.
Yeah, it's called The Turning Point,
yes.
It's a great little insight into, you know, local politics in Southwest Georgia in a time and a place, 1962, and you really get a sense of the characters. You know, when I had to go back and essentially re-report that whole thing, because Carter, unlike, say, Lyndon Johnson, he doesn't lie about his past, but he sugarcoats it sometimes. And, you know, there were some things that he sugarcoated a little bit in that account, but you're right. It is a good book. My favorite of his books is called An Hour Before Daylight, and it's about his boyhood. And you know, he grew up barefoot without any running water or electricity. I mean, he might as well have been living in the 19th century. He really lived in three centuries, you know, raised essentially in the 19th century, even though he's born in 1924. And then, of course, you know, an important figure in the 20th century. And in the 21st century, the Carter Center is on the cutting edge of global health and democracy promotion, conflict resolution, all the big issues of the 21st century. So I can't think of another figure, even one who led the kind of epic American life that Carter did, who really spans three centuries.
Jonathan, my last question, do you have a favorite quote or moment from his presidency?
When he gave his farewell address in 1981, 40 years ago this week, he said, "American values are not luxuries, but necessities. They are not the salt in the bread, but the bread itself," which I thought was a beautiful line. And, you know, and one that's important for us all to keep in mind right now.
That's the perfect way to wrap up this really fascinating discussion. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us on American POTUS.
So much to this man.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
The American POTUS podcast is produced by the National Museum of American Presidents, graphic design by the Thought Bureau, and original music score by Jonathan Clark Music. If you'd like to find out more about today's guest, or if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, simply visit AmericanPOTUS.com. Plus, you can always send us a note on one of our social pages on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Finally, it's our presidential last word from Jimmy Carter. Quote, "America did not invent human rights. In a very real sense, human rights invented America."